negotiating credibility, asserting veracity. Although Wolf understands his autobiography to be the subjective testimony of a time full of contradictions, he also recognizes the need to establish his credibility as the narrator and protagonist of his life story. He uses statements of purpose and disclaimers in the prefaces to control his image and manage reader expectations. Subtle differences in the German and American editions suggest keen audience awareness and offer insights into how he wants his life story to be read. Man Without a Face, he writes in the preface, is not a confessional bid for personal redemption, and its author seeks neither moral justification nor forgiveness. Recognizing that readers may question his version of events, he nonetheless remains adamantly unapologetic about his political convictions and his life work, writing, "I seek no pardon as a representative of the losers." Similarly defiant in tone, the introduction to Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg includes a disclaimer about omissions and limits to his self-disclosure. Citing a moral responsibility toward agents who worked for him, he asks for the reader's indulgence when he doesn't name names, exercise restraint in some instances, and in others is completely silent. His caution is understandable because West Germans who worked for the MFS and had not been exposed after unification could still be subject to prosecution under German law. Addressing necessary omissions allows him to appear transparent and to superficially satisfy his end of the autobiographical pact with his German readers, namely the commitment to truthfulness, without violating his professional and moral obligation to individuals who spied for the GDR. Both the English language and the German introductions exhibit concern about what readers will believe or understand. In Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg, Wolf begins with an acknowledgement of the high expectations of his readers and that writing such a book is a gamble, because touting the success of East German espionage after the spectacular dissolution of the GDR may appear arrogant to many. However, he insists on his right to recount and examine in detail the successes and failures of his career, as well as his hope that the story of the period as he lived it can also be understood on the other side of the Iron Curtain that has disappeared. As a citizen of post-unification Germany and a defendant in German courts at the time of his writing, it is hardly surprising that the German edition adopts a more conciliatory tone in explaining the imperatives of East German espionage. One strategy for establishing narrator credibility, evident in Wolf's autobiographies, is the anticipation of reader skepticism. For example, when he writes, "One of the occupational hazards for a spymaster is that one usually isn't believed, even when telling the truth," or when seeking to establish the veracity of his account by providing material proof to substantiate claims about his political views in the form of diary entries in the appendices to the German edition. Indeed, no life story can be perceived as credible unless the writer admits to mistakes over the course of his or her life from which lessons can be drawn. Admitting to false thinking and personal failings, Wolf accepts that he must learn to take responsibility for activities of his ministry and those aspects of the system he had served and perpetuated, even though they lay outside his own experience, knowledge, or consent. At the time of the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961, for example, he was convinced of the necessity of intelligence work and deeply committed to it. 13 years later, on the 25th anniversary of the founding of the GDR, he questions the value of intelligence work in a diary entry. substantiating his claim that such doubts predated his retirement from the MFS and the collapse of the GDR is the transcribed diary entry in an appendix to the German edition. In a curious oversight, however, this particular entry is not among the facsimiles of handwritten diary entries, leaving the reader to trust he actually held these views in the 1970s. Many of his admissions of culpability are vague, such as, "I do not claim ignorance of the brutalities of life within our own country," and, "While I did not abet terrorists as such, we certainly did train people in methods that were later abused." Tacit admissions of this kind beg the question of actual knowledge and complicity. Wolf also employs the first person plural, whether as the pluralis majestatis or a collective we, in the way East Germans were socialized to think of themselves as part of a whole, for statements of generalized accountability such as, "We erred. We did many things wrong and were too late in recognizing the mistakes and their causes," and "We didn't realize that the impetus for reform had to come from us." Christoph Jung, Ute Hirsekorn, and Martin Sabro have identified similar patterns of argumentation in the autobiographies of other former SED officials after 1989. Not all of Wolf's admissions of error are written in the first person plural. However, the sudden switch from first person singular to plural in the following example illustrates his tendency to assign guilt or failure to many. When the long-expected reforms finally came with Mikhail Gorbachev's ascension to power, no one was more enthusiastic for our future than me. But we did not foresee that the change had come too late. In this passage, Wolf, the individual, is enthusiastic about Gorbachev's ideas and uses the first-person singular to align himself with Gorbachev. But Wolf, the party official, is one of many SED elites who failed to see that Glasnost was not going to really solve any of their problems. Thinking in terms of we and depicting himself as part of a system provide Wolf with legal and moral cover when taking stock of his life work. He accepts blanket responsibility for his part in a failed system and country that had a good beginning in anti-fascism but fell short of its ideals. Since the truthful stocktaking of his life work in East German foreign intelligence necessitates a frank assessment of the GDR and its leaders, he must balance both the positive and the negative sides of the East German history. As much as I would prefer to stress its anti-fascist origins, I would never allow myself to pass lightly over the dark side of GDR history. I know that there was a great deal wrong with the GDR, including a terrible amount of repression. I am perfectly aware of my own share in the responsibility for this. I was part of the system. And if people attack me, as they often do, as if I had been head of state, as if I had had total control over everything that happened in the GDR, then that is something I will have to bear. A closer examination of this passage reveals a rhetorical strategy of differentiating himself from the SED leadership and casting himself as the victim of unjust criticism. The as-if statements allow him to downplay his actual importance in the SED state and function to deflect responsibility for political repression in East Germany. Reminding his readers that he was neither head of state nor in a position of absolute power shifts culpability to other high-ranking party officials. In Wolf's autobiographies, the SED abuse of power is often depicted as something beyond his knowledge or control. He is a Stasi general who never saw the inside of a Stasi prison but will have to learn to bear responsibility for activities of his ministry and those aspects of the system he served and perpetuated, even though they lay outside of his own experience, knowledge, or consent. Use of the passive voice in the following statement allows him to imply that he is the victim of these abuses. My own entanglement in the secret side of the Cold War and the experience of the abuse of power done in the name of socialism are deep wounds in my biography. Words like entanglement imply powerlessness, even helplessness, and abuses done in the name of socialism is a passive construction that conceals the identity of the decision makers, while tacitly justifying excesses that may have occurred as mistakes committed for a good cause. Admitting to feelings of shame for the misdeeds of the SED or another section of the MFS does not directly discredit him or his life work. Expressions of remorse and shame are comparatively few, however, and similarly impersonal in Wolff's autobiographies. A man who compares political conviction to setting oneself on a course and not deviating from it, no matter what terrible things you may see along the way, is unlikely to express profound regrets about actions done in the name of those beliefs. Moreover, Wolff frequently cites the Cold War in explaining why the ends justify the means. One of the more personal examples of an impersonal expression of remorse is when he recites from Apologies for Being Human, a poem by his father, Friedrich Wolff, at his retirement party in 1986. It is unclear what he is apologetic about. However, the moral transgressions rumored as reason for Wolff's dismissal may have been one reason for reciting this particular poem, the second stanza of which reads, "And if I hated too much and loved too wild, too free, forgive me for being human. Sainthood was not for me." The quoted text is evidently not impersonal, since it was part of his father's oeuvre, but it is odd that Wolff felt it necessary to apologize through the voice of his father on this particular occasion. The quoted stanza, moreover, creates a strawman apology. He apologizes for ordinary human passions and for not being a saint, as if sainthood were expected of communists like him or his father. The uncertainty of his fate at the time of writing the autobiographies might explain why the discourse of victimization occasionally creeps into Wolff's account of his life. Although a well-connected and powerful party member, he appears resigned and lacking agency in the last years of the GDR. Characterizing the Leipzig Monday demonstrations, which precipitated the peaceful revolution in East Germany, as a catastrophe, allows him to represent himself and the SED as victims of historical processes beyond their control. On the eve of German unification, Wolff once again felt like a hostage to historical events, inviting comparisons between the exile of communists under the Nazis and the ostracism of East German communist leaders after 1989. He acknowledges great bitterness among their officers toward the Soviets, who were disappointed in the Soviet Union for abandoning the HVA in its time of need, but is reticent about his own views regarding East Germany's ally. The arrest and imprisonment of his scouts are also a source of bitterness for Wolff. Victor's justice at the end of the Cold War, according to him, means that the spies of one state go unpunished, whereas those who worked for the other state are sentenced to long prison terms and hefty fines. He blames the distorting prism of the highly unsympathetic German media for stirring up popular hatred of the Stasi and functionaries of the GDR, regardless of the positions a particular individual held, and resents being branded as a symbol of the East German regime when he writes, "My reputation as source of hope, as a supporter of Gorbachev, wasn't worth a damn." Representing spycraft, rumors, cliches, and imagery. The Man Without a Face was, allegedly, a fan of spy fiction and flattered by rumors that he was the model for the Soviet spymaster Karla in the novels of John le Carré. Although le Carré repeatedly refuted the connection and denied intentional parallels between Wolf and the German-Jewish character Fiedler in The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, the rumors persisted and added to Wolf's mystique. While neither fanning nor refuting rumors about himself, Wolf employs a narrative strategy that alternately invokes and dismisses similarities between the real-world HVA and the fictional world of spies. On the one hand, he distances himself and his life work from cliched literary tropes, emphasizing the banality of spy work. Comments such as, "Vast stretches of this work were very boring," function to de-romanticize popular impressions of spycraft and explain the unorthodox decision to run a dozen agents himself. Dramatic stories of HVA operations are often prefaced with disclaimers such as, "What then happened sounds more like a spy thriller than sober reality." On the other hand, his account treads familiar territory for readers of spy fiction. His life story makes for fascinating reading and has no shortage of political intrigue, dangerous missions, secret signals, couriers, double agents, and deadly outcomes. Amused when real-world intelligence imitates art with some of their madcap schemes and daring ruses, striking him as something of a spy thriller cliché, he does not disavow how rough the game had become, but writes, "The clichés established by espionage movies and novels notwithstanding, physical violence was the exception, not the rule." Wolf recalls being painfully aware of his own recourse to the cliched discourse of fictional characters when the CIA attempted to recruit him after 1989. Even though his future was far from certain at this time, he brazenly rejects the offer, suggesting that the weather in Siberia would be just as agreeable to him as the weather in California. He notes wryly the bizarre way in which real conversations in espionage can sometimes imitate the style of spy novels. Tall, handsome, and urbane, Wolf cut a dashing figure and drew obvious comparisons to the most famous character of spy fiction, James Bond. In another example of life imitating art, the real-life spymaster was reputed to be a ladies' man, like Bond. He was known to give special personal attention to certain female agents, and both his first and second marriage ended as a result of affairs. He formed a particularly close bond with HVA supermole Gabrielle Gast and notes that he gave her personal attention because she needed to feel wanted by him. Womanizing is a trait the spymaster apparently shared with his father as well, and while acknowledging his mother's pain over her husband's philandering, he is largely silent on the subject of his own dalliances and their toll on his personal life. Leslie Collett describes in much greater detail, for instance, the messy divorce from his second wife, Christel, whose best friend, Andrea, became the third Mrs. Wolf well after their adulterous affair had become public knowledge. Anticipating that some readers will expect something like a James Bond film or espionage thriller, Wolf writes, "I would be failing to give a truthful picture, however, if I did not reveal in detail some of the more exotic and tragic operations in which my men took part." Such disclaimers allow him to appear candid, while satisfying reader interest in the more colorful and intriguing aspects of espionage. Even when demurring that not every agent is a born James Bond, he invokes reader associations with the literary genre. To outsiders, the world of Secret Services must sometimes appear absurd, their activities at best a senseless game, at worst immoral. Rather than romanticize Cold War espionage the way spy novels do, he admits that people suffered. Life was hard. Crimes were committed by both sides in the global struggle. Like most people in this world, he felt remorse. The use of Romeo agents, who seduced single West German women in important administrative positions in government and industry, was one of the most sensational and controversial chapters in East German espionage. Striking a rare note of false modesty, Wolf writes, "If I go down in espionage history, it may well be for perfecting the use of sex in spying, a practice he dates back to biblical times." Protesting that the link between sex and spying is no invention of mine, he nonetheless acknowledges that his reputation and some of the more spectacular successes of the HVA can be traced back to the work of his Romeos. The chapter, Spying for Love, both normalizes and romanticizes the deployment of Romeo agents, arguing that other intelligence agencies engaged in similar practices, although without as much success, and that it was natural for single male agents operating in the Federal Republic to fall in love while on the job. Eager to stress that genuine romantic relationships often resulted, he omits how Romeos were trained and set upon single women to exploit their need for love and draw them into the operational plans of the HVA. Indeed, he is more amused by the caper than remorseful about the deceit perpetrated on one of his Juliets, women who aided Romeos and sometimes became spies for the GDR, when he describes the elaborate efforts to create a Potemkin wedding ceremony with an HVA officer posing as a priest for a strict Catholic West German woman who felt guilty about living in sin with her Romeo. Rather than lose an asset, Wolf devised a ruse to assuage her guilt and keep the intelligence pouring in. There is little remorse for such deceptions because he was running an intelligence agency, not a Lonely Hearts Club. In the final analysis, whenever Wolf poses the question to himself about HVA methods and dubious outcomes, he concludes that the ends justified the means. Man Without a Face is not a tell-all book, as Craig R. Whitney notes in the foreword. Neither is Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg. The consummate spymaster, while wanting to appear straightforward with his readers, reserves his right to silence. He is cautious in what he reveals and how much he tells. The spy stories he commits to paper are already a matter of public record. The agents he writes about have been exposed, arrested, and prosecuted. Indeed, he admits at one point that he had hoped to write the story of his life work without mentioning certain agents who are included in the book only because their cover was blown. Wolf is similarly careful in expressions of personal culpability, to avoid opening himself to additional legal problems. Like other former SED elites, Wolf found himself in an unenviable situation after the East German state collapsed. In writing several memoirs and making numerous public appearances, the man who had spent a lifetime in the shadows threw himself into the limelight and in the crosshairs of contentious debates about the Stasi and the East German past. His autobiographies are marked by the ambiguous space of post-unification Germany as he attempts to navigate in the shifting terrains of political discourses. In contrast to other high-ranking officials whose autobiographies have been analyzed by Hilsekorn and Jung, Wolf was neither a Politburo member nor the head of a ministry. He nonetheless wielded considerable power, had access to the inner circles of East German leadership, and enjoyed a privileged lifestyle available to only the highest party officials. His autobiographies, however, tell a different story, one that puts him at odds with his boss and party and, most importantly, not in a position of power when the wall fell. Although politically encumbered by his decades of service, his voluntary retirement 3 years earlier and his belated, half-hearted engagement for reform allow him to exploit the ambiguity of his status as former power holder and potential change agent in his autobiographies. Both the German publisher of Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg and the American publisher of Man Without a Face represent the ambiguity and uncertainty of Wolf's situation at the time of publication in fascinating ways. The front covers to both editions visually reinforce his reputation as a man without a face, the spook renowned for being unknown for most of his career. The color palette is dark, and Wolf's face is obscured. The front cover of Man Without a Face is a medium shot by the East German photographer Sibylle Bergemann of Wolf standing on a dark Berlin street, his head framed by a gun's sight. The bullseye is fixed on the pixelated face, rendering it unrecognizable. The gun sight dramatizes the precarious situation of the successful spy master and performs Wolf's claim, explicitly stated only in the English language edition, that he was a wanted man in unified Germany. The back cover has the same shot as the front, minus the gun sight, and with everything other than Wolf's face pixelated, as if its protagonist had emerged from the shadows through the process of writing the autobiography. The evolution from faceless spook to visible figure performs one part of Lejeune's autobiographical pact, the sincere effort of the author to write about his life in a way that makes it understandable to himself and the reader. The front cover of Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg uses what appears to be the same photo. It is a high-contrast close-up headshot of Wolf with half his face obscured in shadow, the other half in light. The last photograph in the German edition is of Wolf in front of the Max Engels Monument in Berlin in 1993. He stands, literally, with the founders of communism. On the opposite page are the words that best summarize how he has defended himself in court and in his autobiographies. Not far from my apartment in the center of Berlin, young people sprayed the words, "We are not guilty," on the Max Engels Memorial. They are right. The Cold War is over. A model of socialism that began with great hope has failed, but I have not lost my ideals. However, the image on the opposite page undermines his claim of innocence, for his body blocks part of the graffiti so that it actually reads, "We guilty." Although almost certainly unintentional, the contradiction between text and image introduces a level of ambiguity for the reader's consideration. Marcus Wolf's life story intersects with and is informed by the political conditions and social forces that defined German and European history in the 20th century. As a young boy, he fled Nazi Germany with his family for the Soviet Union. He returned to Germany in 1945 to build up East German foreign intelligence and defend the East German state during the Cold War, and was put on trial twice as an ex-Stasi general in reunited Germany. His entire professional life coincided with the Cold War, which also informed it. the Soviet-trained political agitator working for the Berliner Rundfunk in post-war Germany, the advisor to East Germany's diplomatic mission in Moscow, whose very person and career embodies the East German ideal of German-Soviet friendship, the Stasi general who cooperated so closely with the KGB that he was considered Moscow's man in Europe, and the supporter of Gorbachev's perestroika in a reform-resistant GDR, disillusioned with intelligence work in later years. His life writing, by contrast, is entirely the product of a post-GDR era, a radically changed political context from the one that formed the identity of the writing self. Altered social and political circumstances, as well as criminal proceedings, forced Wolf to reassess the values he lived by and the state he supported. While ultimately reaffirming his political convictions, the trajectory and meaning of his life were profoundly shaped by the time of his writing. Throughout the 1990s, he fashioned and refashioned his life story, telling it in multiple venues to different audiences and with different emphases. He wrote out of a perceived moral obligation, both personally as well as politically, to defend the GDR, the HVA, and his life from defamation. An inscription in the copy of Man Without a Face, purchased by the author of this chapter in a used bookstore in Berlin, is from the late German television producer Thomas Wilkening to German film director Wolfgang Petersen. It reads, "Dear Wolfgang Petersen, even though this biography of Marcus Wolf conceals more than it reveals, so typical of Secret Service, it is instructive in many regards. In my opinion, Wolf certainly offers a highly interesting prototype for a strong filmic character." Wilkening's dedication recognizes two important aspects of Wolf's autobiography that have been argued in this chapter. Wolf's autobiographies, while informative, are strategic in their self-fashioning. They do not reveal too much and are careful to omit information that would be damaging to the spymaster or the agents who worked for him. Discretion is the habitus typical of the Secret Service, and the HVA chief proves the master of discretion as narrator of his life story. He also presents himself as a strong leading man in his own life story, which has a narrative arc common to many spy thrillers. Wolf prefers to see his life work, however, in the tradition of anti-fascist and communist heroes like Harro Schulze-Boysen and Richard Sorge, whom he claims as his role models in anti-fascist agitation and intelligence work. Recalling their martyrdom allows Wolf to compare his life work with their heroic sacrifice, much as he conflated parts of his own biography with his brother's in Die Troika, and to suggest that, like them, he too has been a victim of anti-communist vilification. In this way, both Man Without a Face and Spionagechef im Geheimen Krieg contribute to a specific subset of communist autobiography known in the HVA as the preservation of tradition, Traditionspflege, that is designed to cultivate a strong sense of pride in the history of East German espionage. While acknowledging errors and false thinking that led to the collapse of the East German state, Wolf's autobiographies mount a strong defense for the honor of the HVA and the political conviction and professionalism of his agents. Unrepentant in his political convictions and with undiminished pride in directing the most successful espionage agency in Europe, Wolf makes no apologies for being on the losing side of the Cold War. 3. The Stasi's Secret War on Books. Uwe Berger and the Cold War Spy as Informant and Book Reviewer. Allison Lewis. In the German Democratic Republic, GDR, espionage was integral to the world of books and writing. Throughout the Cold War, the Ministry for State Security, MFS or Stasi, policed all aspects of the production and dissemination of literature in the context of culture wars waged against the West and fought out on a domestic stage. A key weapon in the war against homegrown, so-called hostile negative, feindlich negativ literature was other writers, reviewers, and editors, many of whom the Stasi recruited as informers. It is no secret that the Stasi enlisted prominent literary figures such as Hermann Kant, the president of the German Writers Guild, Deutscher Schriftstellerverband, and members of the unofficial underground, such as Sascha Andersson. But it also conscripted a few influential secret police informants, what the Stasi referred to as unofficial collaborators, inoffizielle Mitarbeiter, IM, as peer reviewers of book manuscripts and published books. These informer reviewers have to date remained faceless. While they have certainly not been forgotten by the writers who were the targets of their damning indictments, the informers themselves have been quick to run for cover and to erase their Stasi activities from the public record. Some, such as poet and novelist Uwe Berger, have set up personal websites documenting their life's work that make no mention of working for the Stasi. In the context of such willful forgetting, this chapter attempts to write back into post-Cold War history an important side story in the Stasi's secret war on literature, namely the untold account of the Stasi informers who were responsible for writing classified book reviews. In the absence of autobiographical testimony from these spies, Cold War spy stories of Stasi informers are best told as a file story, composed primarily from the extensive and telling traces left behind in the Stasi files. I will first explore Berger's personal and professional motivations for working as a Stasi informer and reviewer before demonstrating how these played out in the censorship process. Through a close reading of his evaluations of literature and his Stasi file, I will analyze the salient features of his reviewing in relation to literary aesthetics and politics, features that point to Berger's self-understanding as an aesthetic gatekeeper on the one hand and an ideological policeman on the other. Finally, from this I will attempt to extrapolate Berger's position and position-taking in the literary field over the duration of his association with the Stasi, and to contextualize his Stasi activities against the backdrop of shifts in cultural politics in the GDR. I argue that, while continuing to work as a poet, Berger waged his own secret war in his capacity as a Stasi-appointed freelance reviewer. It was a war that he was to lose incrementally, and one that did immense harm to those writers and books that came into his purview. He did so, moreover, for reasons that only partially overlapped with the Stasi's. Censorship in the GDR and the Stasi. After the opening of the Stasi archives in 1992, when many victims of the East German regime gained access to their declassified secret police files, countless Stasi informants among the writing fraternity were exposed and named, including Uwe Berger. Joachim Walter's monumental 1996 study of the Stasi's surveillance of literature detailed Berger's activities for the Stasi both as an informer and as a secret censor of literature. In 1997, Günter Kunert identified Berger in his memoir Erwachsenenspiele as one of three colleagues who spied on him, and the source of a damning review of one of his works, a denunciation masquerading as academic analysis, which unequivocally branded him an enemy of the state. Despite the increased attention to informants in recent research on the Stasi, we know very little about figures such as Berger. We also do not fully understand how the secret book reviews the Stasi commissioned, which will be exemplified here in Berger's story, fitted into the overall censorship process, and whether his reviews were effective in blocking publications. Censorship studies of the GDR have hitherto tended to fall into two categories: either publication histories of censored works or biographical studies of victims of censorship, rather than those involved in the censoring. Volker Braun's Hinze-Kunze-Roman and Christa Wolff's Nachdenken über Christa T., Quest for Christa T., are examples of the former, and Jurek Becker and Günther Kunert, examples of the latter. In both these strands of research, the Stasi appears in the role of a shadowy minor player, stepping onto the stage as an occasional antagonist rather than as a protagonist in its own right. Yet if we shift perspective for a moment to this antagonist and put the spotlight on the Stasi's involvement in censorship, we discover new perspectives that can serve to enrich accounts of censored works and their authors, what Carol Ann Costabile-Hemming has called the stories behind the stories. The Stasi was, in addition to its monitoring of writers suspected of being part of a Western-led inner opposition or political ideological diversion, a key social actor in the censorship process. As Sarah Jones has demonstrated in her case study of Hermann Kant, who was a victim of censorship while also being an informant, the Stasi was a constant, if not rather opaque, presence in the negotiations over censorship, exerting its influence across the entirety of the literary field, from informants working for publishers, informants inside the Writers Guild, and officers who liaised with the Ministry for Culture. One of the functions the Stasi assumed was intervening in censorship. In many instances, the Ministry for Culture based its case for banning a work on the foundations laid by so-called expert reviews, written by fellow writers working on consignment for the secret police. With the salvaging of these reviews of literary texts, many of which are now housed in the archives of the Ministry for Culture, as well as the Stasi Documents Archive, BSTU, comes the opportunity to read them in connection with the Stasi's declassified personnel files on informers. This allows us to join the dots between reviews penned by the same reviewers and to fold these diachronic accounts into the life history of informers as well as the lives of their victims. It enables us, therefore, to read backward from the literary reviews authored by Berger and to adduce his motivations for willingly participating in secret wars on publishing. The world of publishing in the GDR was, with few exceptions, highly politicized, as was virtually the entire literary field. The relationship between power and intellectuals was from the start highly volatile and precarious, and remained so throughout the 40 years of the GDR's existence. While all literary fields are at some level suffused by power and or economics, in the GDR, the production of literature was politically and ideologically driven by the ruling party, the Socialist Unity Party of Germany, Sozialistische Einheitspartei Deutschlands, SED, and its intricate system of controls. Censorship consisted of a web of interlocking structures that was susceptible to political influence at each of the points inside the web: The censorship apparatus, or censorship dispositif, was spread across five separate bodies: the publishers, the SED, the main directorate for publishing and book trade, Hauptverwaltung Verlage und Buchhandel, HV, in the Ministry for Culture, Ministerium für Kultur, the Office for Copyright, Büro für Urheberrechte, and last, as the fifth censor, the Stasi. While the HV functioned as the last instance of power, the Stasi represented an additional instrument of censorship, an extra rear guard line of defense that could be mobilized to police works and their authors. Like the publishers, the Stasi relied heavily on literary experts, mostly writers and sometimes university professors, to assess works' suitability for publication. To play its part, as the party's sword and shield, or as Jens Giesecke writes, as the unconditional bodyguard of the party leadership, and to provide support for the centralized control of literary communication, the Stasi commissioned its own reviews. These were provided by its own specialists, whom it recruited in a dual capacity as both experts and informants. The Stasi enlisted various types of informants, ranging from the most common category of informer for the political operative penetration and securing of the area of responsibility, inoffizieller Mitarbeiter zur politisch-operativen Durchdringung und Sicherung des Verantwortungsbereichs, IMS, to the more specialized category of informer for special purposes, inoffizieller Mitarbeiter für einen besonderen Einsatz, IME, which was an expert informant for matters beyond a case officer's normal skills. It imposed the usual conditions of secrecy and required informants to sign an oath pledging loyalty. Following Michel Foucault's lead in reconceptualizing power as a dispersed force permeating the social body, scholars of literary communication have long argued for reassessing notions of censorship as purely prohibitive and repressive. Beate Müller contends that censorship should no longer be regarded as a direct form of regulatory intervention by the state or church. Instead, we should see it, as does Sophia Rosenfeld, as a constitutive part of the discourse and communication it purports to control or regulate. Furthermore, we could argue, as does Judith Butler, that censorship is not merely privative, but formative as well, producing both speech and subjects. Approaches such as these have encouraged a rethinking of censorship as an intrinsic part of the assemblage of the institutions that make up the literary field and that control the flow of communication. While analyses of cultural regulation in democratic societies tend to call all kinds of exclusionary mechanisms censorship, many critics still insist on making meaningful distinctions between the rather different forms of control operating in democratic and totalitarian societies. Müller, for instance, argues that there are clear differences between the mechanisms that filter communication, such as the market or expert opinion, and the sorts of authoritarian interventions by a third party in dictatorships. I would argue, however, that the regulation of literary discourse in Eastern Bloc dictatorships was not only located in third-party interventions subject to direct political control, but that censorship could also involve skilled professionals who provided expert opinion and carried out peer review. These professionals policed ideological as well as aesthetic dimensions of discourse. Most of these experts were commissioned openly by the publishers, but some were deployed covertly behind the scenes by the Stasi. The Stasi's experts conducted reviews of manuscripts that often competed with the publishers' reports in what could evolve into protracted power struggles. Hence, censorship as well as self-censorship occurred rarely, as Jörg Gotthard Mix writes, as a total confrontation, and was a complex, multi-layered affair negotiated, as Sarah Jones points out, via a maze-like system of controls, between multiple cultural agents and institutions operating in the literary field. The literary field, especially at the intersection with power, was, as Stephen Parker and Matthew Philpotts have suggested, a dynamic rather than a static site of struggle in which agents competed to secure and exchange capital in its various forms. Censorship, I contend, was but one of the ways in which social agents, writers, publishers, editors, ministerial employees, ministers, members of the Politburo, as well as Stasi agents, all vied to secure, exchange, and control the circulation of literary capital. However, far from being a battle merely between the main censors, the main directorate for publishing and book trade and writers, censorship could also involve ancillary struggles between other players. As we are beginning to understand better, it could entail power plays between the Stasi and the Ministry for Culture, the Stasi and publishers, as well as tugs of war between the Stasi and the Writers Guild, and even between the Stasi's informants and the Stasi itself. The Stasi's recruitment of Berger, context and motivation. The case of Uwe Berger can help illuminate some of these censorship battles fought over the written word. Berger was initially registered in 1969 as an informant involved in the processing and exposure of persons suspected of hostile activity, IMV, before being upgraded to an expert informant, IME, in 1979. Choosing the undercover name of Uwe, Berger amassed a thick, multi-volume Stasi file of 2,255 leaves. Like many writers the Stasi attempted to enlist, Berger, who was born in 1928 in Eschwege in Hessen, was chosen because of his positive political attitude and his professional standing as a writer. His commissioning officer, Lieutenant Rolf Pönig, wrote in justification of his plan to recruit Berger, "The aforementioned candidate is found to be suitable for political operative counterintelligence work among writers and poets. It is planned to win him over to collaborating with the MFS and to develop him as an IMV. The candidate is himself a poet and a literary critic and possesses extensive contacts to the circles mentioned below." Berger was, it seems, thought to be a good catch for the Stasi, especially in the wake of the crushing of the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia in 1968. At the time, a sizable number of writers in the Writers' Guild, of which Berger was a member, had either abstained or absented themselves from the vote on a resolution in support of the suppression of the Czech reform movement. Berger had endorsed the regime and voted for the resolution. He was 100% loyal, having been awarded the Johannes R. Becher Medal in 1961 and the Heinrich Heine Prize in 1968. When Section 2, Referat 2, in the MFS's main department, Hauptabteilung HA 20/7, made the decision to enlist him as an informant, on November 25, 1969, he was employed on a contractual basis by Aufbau to write reviews of literary manuscripts. Prior to this, he had worked as an editor for the publisher Volk und Wissen and later for Aufbau from 1949 to 1955, before going freelance. The immediate occasion for his recruitment was the Stasi's concern to gauge the political climate inside Aufbau. Berger, along with Günter Deike, was one of the editors of an important new poetry anthology, Die Lyrik der DDR, Poetry of the GDR, which Aufbau was in the process of publishing and which was due to appear in 1970. The collection, which was reissued several times, included some 52 poets, one of whom was Berger. As the nation's flagship publishing house, Aufbau was naturally of paramount interest to the regime. Berger was most likely thought to be a valuable source close to the center of power at Aufbau, a center that was seen as vulnerable and unstable. The Stasi had become interested in Günter Kaspar, who in 1963 was head of Zeitgenössische Deutsche Literatur, Department for Contemporary Literature. Kaspar had been a member of the Berlin Donnerstagskreis, Thursday Circle, of Reform Socialists, and was friends with leading critics of the regime, Walter Harich, Wolfgang Janka, and Gustav Just, who were convicted in show trials in 1956. On October 9, 1970, some 7 months after Berger's recruitment, Kaspar was also approached by the same officers, Rolf Pönig and Peter Gütling, to work as a Stasi informant. But unlike Berger, Kaspar rebuffed the approach, and by confessing to have a peculiar character trait that meant he could not keep a secret, he managed to fob the Stasi off. The Stasi was probably nonplussed about this refusal, since, as it transpired, it already had a long-standing informant high up in Aufbau in Fritz Georg Vogt, or IMS/IMF Kant, who was director of the publishing house from 1966 onward. The Stasi believed at the time that around 60% of its informants were prompted by recognition of society's need to collaborate with the secret police, as Manfred Hempel found in his PhD dissertation on the effect of moral factors on informants completed at the Stasi's university, the Juridical University of the MFS, Juristische Hochschule des MFS, in Potsdam, in 1967. However, as even Hempel's ideologically biased study revealed, many informants had secondary motives over and above political ideological conviction. Berger's official motivation was, as his file implies, his positive political ideological beliefs, but his secondary, ulterior motives remain something of a mystery. At the time he was recruited, Berger was not out of favor with the regime, and, as far as we know, was not threatened or coerced to collaborate. There is also no indication that Berger agreed in the short term to further his literary career, or because he was having difficulties publishing or indeed passing the censorship authorities. Berger's works had not suffered from any notable delays and were not in any danger of being censored. Indeed, in 1968, Berger received prompt official approval from the main directorate for publishing and book trade to publish a volume of poetry. In his self-reporting to his officer, the picture that emerges from Berger's Stasi files is of an extremely combative and manipulative member of the Aufbau team of editors and authors. Berger often appears envious of other writers, anxious that he was not being given enough manuscripts to review, and fearful of being marginalized. On file are numerous references to infighting in the publishing house and to regular squabbles with Kaspar. On one occasion, on November 5, 1970, Kaspar rang Berger to berate him. "You tricked me!" after learning that Berger had phoned the poet Sara Kirsch and blamed Kaspar, and not himself, for writing a negative review of her poetry. On another occasion, a few months later, Kaspar lambasted him for writing a bad review of a work that Kaspar hoped to publish, declaring it was the most subjective thing Berger had ever written. Berger, for his part, is captured on file conspiring against Kaspar, complaining hypocritically, for example, to Vogt that Kaspar was insincere and scheming. In June 1972, there is talk of almost daily disputes between Kaspar and Berger over the selection of poems, which he refers to as the tough, unpleasant running battles holding up work which are worse than ever. We also find evidence on file that Berger disapproved of the fact that open critics of the regime, such as songwriter and poet Wolf Biermann and poet Rainer Kunze, were flouting censorship processes and copyright laws. He lamented as much to his officer at the outset of his collaboration, expressing hopes that progressive forces in the Writers Guild, such as himself, might be given more support. As the ex-Stasi officer and infamous defector Werner Stiller admitted in an interview in 2010, resentment among his informants was a prime motivator, and he looked to recruit people who felt disadvantaged or insufficiently recognized by their superiors. Recruiting those who were bitter was, he confessed, surprisingly easy. If we read between the lines of his Stasi reports, Berger could be interpreting as resenting that he was not receiving proper recognition in the literary community. In collaborating, Berger no doubt hoped to gain an advantage that might bolster his standing among his peers, which he felt was weakened by, among other things, the loopholes writers were exploiting by bypassing censorship and publishing in the West. For a collaboration between the Stasi and its informants to succeed, especially if no grounds for blackmail or coercion existed, there clearly needed to be other factors at work. Very few writers agreed to collaborate for financial gain. Berger was remunerated reasonably well for his reviews, to be sure, and received between 200 and 400 marks for each of his reports. But this cannot be the sole reason for his extraordinarily high level of engagement. Certainly his hardline ideological views and resentment of his peers meant that he regarded working for the Stasi more as an opportunity than a burden. Reading between the lines of his expansive file and interpreting some of the key events that structure his file story, it seems fair to say that Berger not only relished undercover work, but that he went to extraordinary lengths to keep the Stasi happy. An alarming instance of Berger's eagerness to please can be found while his wife was dying of cancer between August and October 1970. Throughout her illness, Berger was content to hold regular meetings with his case officer, as Pönig testified in his report on August 6, 1970. This matter is troubling the IM immensely at the moment. Nevertheless, he declared to this staff member that we can approach him with tasks because the work must go on. Pönig noted at the next two meetings on September 8th and October 4th that Berger was unable to leave his flat because his wife was too ill. The best indication, however, of Berger's determination to please the Stasi is the fact that he redoubled his efforts to carry out his Stasi assignments even during his wife's sickest hours. His task at the time was to firm up the contact to Paul Wiens, determine the causes of the political changes in the behavior of Paul Wiens. As his file reveals, Berger worked proactively on this task, using his wife's sickness as an excuse to phone fellow writer and poet Paul Wiens on August 8, 1970. Wiens had been president of the Berlin branch of the Writers Guild from 1961 to 1969, but had come under suspicion after the Prague Spring. Although Wiens had worked for the Stasi from 1962 to 1968, he was seen as such a threat that his telephone was tapped from 1968 to 1971. Much was at stake in preventing Wiens from straying too far from the party line. In the days after his wife's death, Berger called Wiens again to try to engineer a visit from him. Wiens duly obliged, whereupon Berger passed off the visit as an espionage success to Pönig. The atmosphere of the conversation was familiar, On entering, Veens embraced me as an expression of sympathy. Our relationship is, at least in Veens's opinion, characterized by mutual respect and tolerance, a tolerance that is also based on opposing views. Veens invited me to return the visit. Berger thus exploited the occasion of his own recent bereavement, deploying his own misfortune as a pretext to phone Veens, anticipating that his wife's death would bring him closer to Veens, whom he could then milk for intelligence. Berger's sneaky undercover habitus and rather spiteful disposition come into even sharper focus in relation to his mission to keep Veens under surveillance. From Berger's accounts for the Stasi, it seems that he denounced Veens whenever the opportunity arose. For instance, he implied that Veens had no compunctions about expressing approval for Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik and watching West German television, something that was frowned on in party circles. Veens made no effort to hide his nonconformist, reform socialist views about cultural politics after a trip to Yugoslavia. He complained about our cultural politics. We should let people write what they want. Reports such as these were designed to mark Veens as a troublemaker and as someone the regime needed to be vigilant about. Moreover, many of Berger's reports about Veens are petty and catty and read rather like a schoolboy telling on a naughty friend to a teacher. On one occasion, he relayed the fact that Veens had told him two political jokes in which the socialist system of planning and control, as well as the GDR, was questioned or demeaned. Of the two poets, Veens had greater access to travel privileges. Berger only traveled to socialist countries, while Veens was able to visit capitalist countries. And the lesser of the two literary lights may have been envious of his colleague's international lifestyle. Berger certainly appears to have been in awe of Veens's chutzpah, which can be seen from a snide comment Berger made to his officer in 1970. He, Veens, thinks he'll make an impression if he is a martyr. In many respects, Berger's surveillance of Veens thus reads as a kind of clandestine payback designed to cut him down to size. It is not clear whether in 1970 Berger suspected that Veens had been an informant for the Stasi in the 60s, and, indeed, whether later on he knew that Veens had resumed working for the Stasi after Veens was rehabilitated in 1972. It can probably be assumed that over time he gathered that Veens, like himself, might also be enjoying the protection of the secret police. It is likely that Berger was also aware that the aforementioned director of Aufbau, Vogt, was working for the Stasi. We can deduce this from a throwaway comment made by Vogt, captured on file, that the Stasi had taken objection to a fellow poet's work, whereupon Vogt added, "But I probably should not be telling you this." If Berger did suspect Veens was also a Stasi collaborator, he seems to have resented it, especially since Veens received more benefits than he did. Interestingly, in 1975, he passed on another colleague's exasperated comment that she was sick and tired of Veens always being given preference over her. One could infer that this was also Berger's view. Berger's hard work does appear to have at least been acknowledged by the Stasi. After over 10 years of collaborating, Veens, one of Berger's perennial targets, died on April 6, 1982. A few months before his death, Berger's handler, Captain Pönig, convened a special meeting on February 16, 1982, in the presence of Lieutenant Colonel Brosche. Berger was to be awarded the Medal for Brotherhood in Arms in silver, Medaille für Waffenbruderschaft in Silber. The report filed on the secret ceremony held in a Stasi safe house underscores just how grateful Berger was for the recognition. Uwe stated he felt very honored by this award. would give everything to fulfill the tasks assigned to him, and that the MFS could always count on him to be a reliable collaborator. Moreover, he expressed his close bonds with and devotion to our party and the MFS. He described himself as an impartial patriot on the side of the working class and its party. It is possible that the awarding of the medal was designed to coincide with Berger being groomed to take Wien's place as a key source inside the Writers' Guild.